All this past week, I have been enjoying thinking about the possibility that somebody might just happen by our church this morning and hear the singing and decide to stop in and take a look. And maybe that person would have a seat somewhere in the back and take in the light and airy sanctuary and observe this beautiful and diverse gathering of people. And then maybe that person would notice that there appears to be a bride and groom in the front row. And I've been imagining him silently puzzling to himself, huh, so do Lutheran services like always have somebody dressed in a wedding gown? Is that like part of the weekly program? You know the answer, but just in case, no, it is not. It's pretty rare for us to celebrate a wedding in our Sunday morning worship service. This is a first for me, as it might be for some of you as well. But church is a community where we mark the events of our lives, where we give thanks for fresh possibilities and pray for healing and rejoice in the gift of a newborn child and honor the faith of young people and grieve the death of a friend. So it's natural and wonderful that we get to surround Jane and Mateo today as they are married after 14 years of marriage, as Mateo put it last Sunday. It is part of our life as a community. Still, this is not a typical wedding service. There is no 1 Corinthians 13, love is patient, love is kind, or Song of Solomon 2, arise my love, my fair one, and come away. Instead, we've got Mark 9. What were you arguing about on the way? Not exactly typical wedding fare. But that's where we are in Mark's gospel. So here we go. On a first hearing, the disciples' argument in our reading today sounds utterly ridiculous. They are not discussing important things, the best way to continue in their ministry in the coming season, or the ways Jesus' teaching is challenging their old patterns, or how to balance time on the road with time back home with their families. No, they are arguing, Mark tells us, about who was the greatest. It is hard not to imagine this scene as anything other than a comedy, I think. Hey, says Bartholomew, you guys all know I can catch more fish than any of you, right? Oh yeah, says James. Well, I was the fastest at picking up the leftover bread on the hill the other day. Jesus totally noticed. I've got you all beat, says Thaddeus. I almost cast out a demon the other day. I am definitely the most promising disciple. I can't imagine any way for their conversation not to sound pointless and petty and pathetic, particularly when you look back at where they have just been. Time and again, the disciples have been missing the point lately. They have been misinterpreting Jesus' words and struggling to keep up with his teaching and failing at doing what he asks. In the passage just before our reading today, a man comes to Jesus with a demon-possessed son. I asked your disciples to cast it out, he says, but they could not do so. Jesus' followers are not looking particularly promising at this point. Then Jesus starts speaking yet again about his death. It's the second time in the gospel that he brings it up. It was clearly a topic that he needed to revisit again and again. This path you're walking with me, he says, is not going to be simply one success after another. It is not going to be a smooth way straight to the top. In fact, it is going to be a very hard road, and you are going to lose me soon. Yet again, the disciples are not getting it, and maybe after the tongue lashings Jesus has given them lately, they've decided it's best simply to keep quiet about that. They did not understand what he was saying, Mark tells us, and were afraid to ask him. And then comes the argument about who's the greatest disciple. Ridiculous, right? Yes and no. Yes, it is totally ridiculous that the disciples are arguing about their status when none of them is able to keep pace with Jesus, when none of them is acing his discipleship exams, when all of them are bewildered. Yes, it is ridiculous. They are fighting about who's on top of the pyramid when Jesus keeps directing them to the people at the bottom. Yes, it is ridiculous that they are concerned about something as petty as looking good before others when Jesus is talking about his betrayal and death. Yes, it is ridiculous. But don't we all act like this sometimes? When I am stressed about something, in my work or my family or the state of the world, I just might have a tendency to get grumpy about the shoes in the entryway of my apartment. Gah, why can't people put their shoes back on the rack when they come inside? Why does everybody just kick them off wherever they feel like it? Look at this place. It's a total mess. Is it really so hard to take the extra 3 seconds and put your shoes back where they belong? Never mind that a pair of my own shoes are also there in the mix. These are not my proudest parenting moments. And when I'm calm enough to reflect on it, I know that usually behind them there is something else. Stresses from the day. Worry about an upcoming event, a problem that I am struggling to understand. When we are worn down and confused, we can get grumpy with others, and we can start grasping for control, doing anything we can to make the world a little more ordered and predictable. These patterns can creep into any of our relationships, with our spouses or partners, with our kids, with our friends, with our colleagues, with our church community. We are struggling with some great thing, living our lives and navigating change and coping with an uncertain world and caring for hurting loved ones. And instead of being open about all of that and being gentle with ourselves and those around us, we pick at some lesser thing. We rehash some old grievance. We try to situate ourselves at the top of the order. That's what I hear in the disciples' argument on the road that afternoon. Did it make Bartholomew feel better to establish his fishing dominance among his friends? Maybe for a moment that did feel like security in the midst of all that was happening with the ground shifting beneath their feet. It's not so hard to imagine, really. Which is maybe why Jesus seems to respond so gently in our reading today. What were you arguing about on the way? He asks. And his companions all get very quiet and are suddenly very interested in the dust on the road. He clearly knows very well what they've been arguing about, but he doesn't berate them like he does with some regularity in Mark's gospel. No, he calls them all close and invites them to sit down, a sure sign that he has something important to teach. Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all, he says. This is what I'm trying to teach you. Life is not about climbing any ladder. It is not about establishing yourself above others. It is not about being the greatest. It is about mutuality and solidarity and care. He gives them this strange and difficult teaching, and then to make it clearer, he calls over a nearby child and embraces him or her. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me, he says. Biblical scholars remind us that children, well, of course, valued in the ancient world, were of the lowest social status, right there with slaves at the bottom of the pyramid. You didn't climb any ladder of respect or power by being kind to children. But it turns out that you do welcome Jesus. He's trying to say in one more way and help his disciples understand, forget the climbing, forget the ladder, love without distinction. That may very well be the meaning of Jesus's action here, but it's when I actually picture the scene that it sinks in for me. Some child, none of the disciples know, suddenly there in front of them, probably a little bit taken aback by the kindness of this strange teacher on the road, a child can reset our perception. Because I think we all know deep down in our bones, that the worth of that little person blinking back at us, whoever she is, has nothing to do with status or rank or money or achievement or recognition or any of the other ways we adults sort ourselves into worthy and unworthy, admirable and scornful, great and not so great. A child is simply herself and of boundless value, just as she is. Do you get it now? I imagine Jesus asking. This is how God makes us. This is how God sees us. So forget who's the greatest. Forget all those comparisons. They are all pointless. Love is where life is. Serving one another is where life is. It sounds so simple, and yet we know that it's not. We know that so much in the world around us tells us to look for our security in being on top, in having more, in being better than others in some way. Smarter, richer, more hip, more powerful, more admired. To find our security simply in the fact that we are loved immeasurably, just as we are, is truly swimming upstream. It can be the work of a lifetime. But the good news, the great grace, is that Jesus keeps calling, keeps inviting, keeps teaching, keeps welcoming us to find ourselves at home and secure in love. And we have one another to point the way, to keep reminding us where life is really found. I think that is a word to all of us engaged in this daily business of following Jesus. And Jane and Mateo, on this day when you make your wedding vows here before God and this community, perhaps it's a particular reminder of the gift of your relationship, of this central place where you are shaped day after day for lives of love and service to one another and to others. We are loved, friends, without measure. That love frees us from competition and climbing and all that restless scrambling. It frees us to love others as the beloved children of God that they are. It is firm ground to stand on. May we find ourselves at home, right there, once again. Amen.